Well, on the one side was a man named William Monroe Trotter, a Boston newspaper editor and activist, once considered nearly as influential as Booker T. Washington. On the other side was pioneer filmmaker D.W. Griffith, credited for ushering film into a new age with his use of multiple camera angles and epic battle sequences. In the middle was the historic film Birth of a Nation, a monument to early movie making, but criticized for its overt racism, which included scenes of black men lusting after white women and the KKK racing to save the day. A new book chronicles William Trotter's epic attempts to censor the movie, a struggle told in Dick Lear's new book, The Birth of a Nation, How a Legendary Filmmaker and a Crusading Editor Reignited America's Civil War. Dick Lear's a former investigative reporter for the Boston Globe and author of Fence, a Police Cover-Up Along Boston's Racial Divide, along with other books. And Dick speaks in Kansas City tonight. More on that in just a bit. What a pleasure to have you, Dick. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Good to be here.
Well, this is such an interesting story, such an interesting showdown. How did you come across this story?
Well, I have to tell you, I knew about the film for a couple of reasons. I knew about it from a college film history course where Griffith's Birth of a Nation is really the anchor in studying American film.
And so many students learn about it even today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's where you start. It's a foundational moment in the history of American film. It was such a breakout movie. So I'd seen it there. And then in the late 70s, I had another screening of it in a more unusual circumstance.
Tell us about that.
I was a young reporter at the Hartford Courant newspaper in Connecticut. And the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, based in Metairie, Louisiana, had picked Connecticut of all states to launch a recruiting drive. Their grand wizard was a man by the name of David Duke, who's a fairly prominent public figure.
Still well known today.
Yeah. And so he had recruited in the fall of 79 for several months, and in December of 79 announced he was coming to Connecticut to meet with his band of followers at a secret meeting. Well, I infiltrated that meeting as a reporter in order to write about it and to expose the Connecticut membership in terms of its numbers and leadership. But what, you know, to our point here today is that his idea of a meeting was to screen The Birth of a Nation. And it's a silent film. So, what we had was listening to Duke's racist narration of the action on the screen, which is, you know, so bigoted and whatnot. So it was at that second screening that I came to understand its true propaganda value.
Just how racist it was.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, just how big a deal, just how big a controversy, Dick, was this fight over The Birth of a Nation, which was released, just about 100 years ago now?
This month.
Okay.
It opened it premiered in L.A. on February 9th. 1915. It moved to New York City in March of 1915 and then came to Boston where there was a real rock and roll protest.
And it came out, and how much controversy did it stir?
Well, it's 100 years ago, so you know it took a while for the controversy to build its momentum because it had to be seen first.
And they didn't have social media in those days.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, it's interesting when the protesters and the civil rights leaders began to organize a response, a protest. It's interesting to go through all the old archives and the letters because they would write, letters to contacts in various cities, say Kansas City or whatnot. Have you heard about this movie coming? If you do, let us know. I mean, so yes, this was way, way before social media. It took a bit to get some protest momentum going. But, you know, right away, a black America realized that this is an outrageous portrayal of Reconstruction and blacks in America, freed slaves and whatnot, while most of America, mainstream America, was just in awe of the technology, the film, and the story because it was a runaway success.
I was going to say this is a new medium, the movies back in those days, so this thing hit pretty hard when it finally came out.
Yeah, that's a real good point, Steve, because we are at the front end of what I think you can call a media revolution, just the way, in some sense, the impact that the digital age has had. People had never seen anything like this. This was the new thing until Griffith's, 3-hour-plus film. things had been short, you know, Nickelodeon, 10, 15, one reelers. This was a 12-reel film. So the length of it.
3 hours, yeah.
The scale and the scope of it, the technology. Again, by our standards today, it seems crude, but in those days, it was the equivalent of Star Wars or Avatar.
The film The Birth of a Nation, it's about what? What's the storyline here?
It's a big story, which matches the ambitions of a big director by the name of Griffith, who's from Kentucky. It's the story of the American Civil War. That's part one. Part two is Reconstruction.
And just how blatantly racist was it?
That comes in mostly in part two, because part one is you know, some extraordinary film making, reenacting Civil War battle scenes, you know, the horrors of war with dead bodies piled up and wisps of smoke and stuff. It's extraordinary filmmaking. Part two, that's where in Reconstruction, where I think, you know, the racist storyline and depiction of blacks is just right in your face.
And we're going to talk about that here. But first, there's no question that D.W. Griffith was a pioneer in what he was trying to do. This was a revolutionary when it comes to the making of films in this country or anywhere else.
Yeah. He just, you know, talk about, breaking through the edges of the envelope and whatnot. Staging the Civil War battle scenes, shooting a master shot and then repositioning the camera to do close-ups and different point of views in order to enhance the experience of the movie. That's a part of, that's its staying power. What's so sad is that he harnessed that power in such, you know, to push such a racist view of Reconstruction.
And was he a racist himself?
I think his prejudice was commonplace for that era. There was more extreme racism. I think the book is based on a novel called The Klansman by a writer named Thomas Dixon, who is just an extreme hater. Griffith was a product of his time, a product of the South. His father, Colonel Roaring Jake, had fought for the Confederacy, and he had grown up his early years hearing stories about the lost cause from his father. So this was his sort of world view. He wasn't a hater, but it was just sort of in his DNA.
You know, I should point out, Dick Lear speaks at 6 tonight at the National World War I Museum. The event is free. To grab a seat, go to the museum's website. Well, let's enter and talk about another man here, Dick, William Monroe Trotter, who was extraordinary himself. In fact, he was the first black student ever elected to Phi Beta Kappa. Just how extraordinary of a young man was William Monroe Trotter?
Yeah, he's a largely forgotten civil rights leader. And you asked earlier, Steve, how I got into this story and writing this book. And frankly, it was Trotter. I was aware of the film, but about 5 or 6 years ago, and I forgot the article. I was reading an article that made mention of Trotter. And
has deep ties to Boston, where you sort of based yourself for many years.
And it described this newspaper editor, a militant crusading newspaper editor in the early 1900s, Boston, Harvard graduate, Harvard's first black Phi Beta Kappa. And I'm going, what? How come I don't know this guy?
Yes, exactly.
I'm Boston-based.
Yeah.
I'm a journalist. I teach journalism. I'm interested in civil rights, that kind of thing. And so I just, you know, obviously I was curious, as journalists tend to be, and I started reading. And that's when I realized that in the early 1900s, he was usually mentioned in the same breath as Booker T. Washington or W.E.B. Du Bois. And I started to think, I'm going to write his biography. And then I came to 1915, and saw that he was at the forefront of this amazing protest in Boston against the movie. And that was my aha moment. That's when I said, this is the story, this action. This is the story to tell and channel, through which to channel so much more about the civil rights movement, about a media revolution, about civil liberties and censorship and stuff. So that's became my, you know, I did all this research and brought it to bear on this protest story.
So when William Trotter sees The Birth of a Nation for the first time, it must have hit him really hard.
It hit him just as most, it hit the same way it hit most black Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I think it, you know, and you know, lynching was a at the time was a in the early 1900s was a real public health concern, a problem, a scam. It was a public spectacle. It was you know, and I think and I've read this in some places that for blacks watching the film then it was sort of the equivalent of feeling lynched or witnessing a lynching, metaphorically speaking. Because the blacks in the film are portrayed as a threat to American values, as lawless, as undeserving of freedom and voting power. It's incredibly offensive.
There was one scene that Griffith even considered removing, and then he sort of waffled on it. Tell us about that scene.
Yeah, there was probably the most famous scene is called the Gus Chase scene. And that involves – it runs for more than 4 minutes or so, and it's a white actor by the name of Walter Lang in blackface playing the ex-slave Gus, who typical of all the blacks in the film has his eyes on a white maiden. And the chase scene is where he's chasing young Flora, played by Mae Marsh, through the fields and through the hills, and for four long minutes, as he becomes almost in his, if you watch his physical movements, almost more ape-like as he's sort of chasing after her.
Yeah,
and she climbs a cliff, and the climax of this scene is that she would rather jump to her death, which she does, rather than submit to a black predatory man. And so that really was, you know, really blatant and way out there. And Trotter and every city, that was sort of the lightning rod of the protest. And so Griffith would, in some cities, promise to modify that, cut it out. He never really eliminated it. He was always tinkering because he was a filmmaker constantly, you know, tweaking his film. And so he often made false promises. He said in Boston, he said he was going to modify or change that, and he never did, and no one held him to it.
We're talking about Dick Lear's new book, The Birth of a Nation, how a legendary filmmaker and a crusading editor reignited America's Civil War. He speaks tonight at 6 at the National World War I Museum. So Trotter goes to see this film, and then he wants to protest it. He wants to censor it. He takes his fight to City Hall. He takes his fight to the State House. What happens?
Yeah, you know, as a result of my research, that's the story that sort of hit me between the eyes is, you know, even when I viewed Birth of a Nation back in college, there was always lip service paid to the fact that, yeah, it's bigoted, it's racist, and it provoked controversy and protest. But I never, until you really drill down and go through all the literature and archival materials that you can and develop, as, you know, journalists, what we call a TikTok. This went on for 3 months in Boston. There was no other protest like it in any other city that took you into City Hall before the legendary Mayor Curley over a censorship hearing, took you to the State House, took you into the courts, took you into mass demonstrations in front of the theater where thousands of protesters were up against hundreds of Boston police, at which there was some violence and Trotter was arrested.
All over a film. It's fascinating.
All over a film. And, mm-hmm. and I I'm scratching my head, because I never knew any of this, and I don't think a lot of people do, maybe specialists in the field. And I'm thinking, 1915, 3,000 blacks marching on the State House in Boston over a film, trying to get the governor to intervene. I go, is this 1915 or 1960?
Yeah, right.
And so it just became this extended saga as. You know, with Trotter at the forefront and the local branch of the NAACP, trying to draw attention to this what I'll call hate speech, trying to assert, and to use borrow another term, that Black Lives Matter, and although their method at in that time, which is also very controversial in hindsight, was to try to ban the film.
And were they successful?
No, they were not. And from my perspective as a journalist and as a First Amendment guy.
That's a tough one, right?
Yeah. I have to in many ways I'm glad they didn't succeed. I think you fight speech with speech, which is what they also were doing. And I think they made it had a lasting and a positive impact on the civil rights movement in terms of a galvanizing and organizing effort. But also they made it clear that they stood up and confronted this film and made it clear that this piece of hate speech is not going to go unanswered. And I think that's the real value of the protest.
To what extent, Dick, did the protests over this film extend outside of Boston and maybe even reach, you know, westward, you know, 1815s early, even for Missouri and Kansas? But how far did the protests spread?
And this is where it became in effect in its own way, a recruiting drive for the still new NAACP, because new branches formed around to protest this. You know, I mentioned that it opened in L.A. and then moved to New York and in Boston in April. Most of it continued through that, you know, inaugural year, and then headed south by late summer and early spring, and premiered in Atlanta in December. There was always met with pockets of protest. Again, nothing like Boston, but it was an organizing tool for the NAACP. There were efforts, because censorship boards were tended to be very at the municipal level, efforts to, you know, to confront it there and whatnot. Some states had statewide censorship boards, and actually, Kansas, the state of Kansas had a state board, and that was one of two or three states that for a while they banned the movie in Kansas.
So this was really, as you're describing the sort of the spread of the NAACP, this is really the foundational part of the civil rights movement that began to spread across the country
back
then.
I think so. And it's a little tricky for the civil rights movement because of that censorship. That's sort of anti-civil libertarian. So it's a complicated but in a good and wonderful way story to unpack. I think I don't have the numbers with me, but if you look at the numbers of the NAACP membership numbers at the beginning of the year and the end of the year and the number of branches, there was a spike. And a big part of that was this thing spreading across the country called the Birth of a Nation.
Well, you're doing a lot to change William Trotter's image. But why did we lose sight of William Trotter for so many decades until Dick Lear came along?
I think there's a couple of reasons. One has to do with his personality. He was not what was politely called an organization man.
Meaning?
He didn't want any part of the NAACP.
Ah.
And so he got sidelined very quickly. The NAACP, was created in 1909 and 1915, and then it burst. But this goes to his independent spirit as well. The early NAACP was – the leadership was white liberal progressives.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Trotter's belief that a national organization for the advancement of colored people should be run by blacks. Mm-hmm. So he didn't want to be part of it. And he tried to have his own organizations. Then they just were no match for the NAACP once they got traction. The other thing is that his wife, Deanie, who was – put out the paper with him, was a big part of the protests against the movie, was indispensable to him.
Mm-hmm.
She died the next year, and he was never the same without her.
Just I want to end on this note, Dick. D.W. Griffith, how did he come to regard his film, The Birth of a Nation, later in his life?
Later in his life, he actually expressed some remorse about the film and the harm it had caused. And it was in an interview that I found that he gave in the early 1940s, because he'd always defended the film in every way. And yet here in this late in life interview, maybe he'd had a couple martinis, who knows, because he was but he did express remorse that for the harm that it caused. He said that blacks have been through enough, that I'm summarizing.
Yeah.
And he thought that perhaps the film, because he was always against any kind of infringement of free expression, should voluntarily not be shown to young people.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Dick Lear's new book, The Birth of a Nation, How a Legendary Filmmaker and a Crusading Editor Reignited America's Civil War. He'll speak tonight at 6 at the National World War I Museum. Show up and grab a seat. And I should point out that for those of you who haven't seen The Birth of a Nation, there will be a screening of it at the Kansas Silent Film Festival on Saturday, February 28th, so a week from now, on the campus of Washburn University in Topeka. Dick, it was a pleasure. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, Steve.